Hello from Gilbert and Tobin. I'm Moya Dodd.
And I'm Matt Rubenstein, and this is The Competitive Edge. What you need to know about competition law in Australia and around the world so fast that we end up going back in time.
Well, today, safety not guaranteed. Amelia McKellar joins us to talk about the consumer guarantees we all enjoy under the Australian consumer law, how the ACCC is enforcing them, and where it's looking for change.
So if the ACCC gets its way, it would mean a complete shift to a contravention-type regime which allows a regulator to enforce, in court, non-compliance with the guarantees without a further finding of any misleading representations having been made. What this means is that the maximum penalties that would apply to non-compliance with the regime would likely be the same as those that apply to the rest of the ACL.
Now, I know that Safety Not Guaranteed is a comedy from 2012 starring Aubrey Plaza from Parks and Recreation, but there's a story behind that, isn't there, Matt?
There sure is. This began in 1997 as a joke by the editor of Backwoods Home magazine, who put a fake classified ad in the back pages when there was some space left over. And the ad read, "Wanted, somebody to go back in time with me. This is not a joke. You'll get paid after we get back. Must bring your own weapons. Safety not guaranteed. I've only done this once before."
Well, that must have got some interesting responses.
It had a lot of responses. It became a meme with a guy in a mullet. It was on the radio and the Jay Leno show, supposedly. Mm. And then they made the movie, which is kind of a romantic comedy about what happens when an intern and her colleagues go to investigate this ad and the possible time traveler who's placed it in a newspaper.
And the movie poster had the original classified ad.
Yeah, the director said that that ad was just perfect and he kept it just the way it was, though without the mallet.
Ah, well, right. But first, or maybe afterwards, Matt, what's been happening around the grounds?
Well, as you know, there's been a lot happening around the literal grounds. The Paris Olympics are 2 months away and the Matildas are playing Germany at 3 a.m. on July 26th, our time. I assume you'll be watching.
Oh, of course. I'll be time travelling to 3 a.m. and then back again for a good night's sleep, perhaps. But before then, of course, we've got friendlies against China on May the 31st in Adelaide and on June the 3rd in Sydney.
And it looks like there are a few single seats left for the Sydney game. So get along if you're single or if you just want to make some new friends.
Oh, isn't that what friendlies are all about? You might even get seated next to one of us, though you don't have to talk to us if you don't want to.
No, you don't have to. And looking a bit further ahead, Australia has also just been selected to host the 2026 AFC Women's Asian Cup.
Yeah, it's great news. It'll be a 12-nation tournament with games to be played in New South Wales, Queensland and WA. And of course, it'll be the final stage of qualifying for the 2027 Women's World Cup, which we now know will be held in Brazil.
That will be a party. The other bids for the Asian Cup came from Saudi Arabia, Jordan and Uzbekistan, who actually withdrew those bids earlier this year. So I'm guessing the announcement wasn't quite as tense as the one for last year's World Cup, where there's that famous video with you in it, Moya.
Thankfully, it's not that tense. And bidders often drop out when it doesn't look like it's going to go their way. And in this case, Uzbekistan will actually be hosting the Asian Cup after us, which has been brought forward to 2029.
Oh, and that's to realign the schedule so that there's 2 years before the World Cup instead of just one.
Pretty much. And, you know, there's quite a lot that goes on behind the scenes in these bids with football federations and FIFA that itself is a bit opaque. In many ways, the federations are technically monopolies and FIFA could be seen as a cartel of monopolies. So there should probably be a FIFA edition of the Monopoly game.
Well, there have been Monopoly editions of 4 of the last 5 World Cups, and there are team editions for most of the Bundesliga and the Premier League teams, including a very special Farewell to Highbury edition for Arsenal in their final season in the old stadium.
But there's no edition about FIFA itself where you, you know, acquire votes in national federations and they offer you a gold watch every time you pass go.
No, there isn't. There have been a couple of recent cases where the European Court of Justice looked at FIFA and the European federations and found that they had dominant positions or even monopolies.
Yeah, in the European Super League case, the court found that FIFA and European football body UEFA held a joint dominant position in the market for organising and marketing inter-club football competitions in the EU.
And they'd abused that position when they said that any players who joined the breakaway Super League would be barred from all FIFA and UEFA tournaments.
Yeah, it's an interesting argument because governing bodies are supposed to regulate for the good of the game, and yet they also have large commercial interests in their own competitions, like the UEFA Champions League, which the European Super League would have challenged. In most industries, you know, we split out the regulatory function so that large entities aren't regulating their competitors. Yet in sport, there's no structural separation or even functional separation between their regulatory and commercial roles.
And the court said that they can still fulfill their roles as governing bodies and regulators of competitions, even though they directly or potentially compete with the bodies they're regulating. But they have to make those decisions for legitimate objectives using transparent, clear and precise criteria and procedural rules.
which I'm sure will lead to another round of debate about legitimate objectives and appropriate criteria.
I'm sure it will. And that case will go back down to the General Court to decide what happens next, but it's a pretty strong statement from the Court of Justice.
Yeah, and on the same day the court decided that UEFA and the Belgian Football Association's rules about homegrown players could breach European competition rules if they had the object or effect of restricting competition between clubs.
Yeah, and in both cases, the court made it really clear that competition law will apply to any economic activities of those bodies, and that includes organising the competition and exploiting the media rights. There's no general exemption for sport in those situations.
Indeed, especially when sport is so much about the money. But what's been going on around the, what's the opposite of literal grounds?
Well, literal now means both literal and the opposite of literal, so we're good.
Oh, so what else has been going on around the literal as in the opposite of literal grounds?
Well, we've also had a budget from the Australian Treasurer, Jim Chalmers, which gives us a bit of an insight into the government's priorities for competition and regulation, at least over the next 12 months or so.
Everyone loves to talk about winners and losers in the budget, so who's a winner here?
The ACCC is a winner again, with about a 10% boost to its funding from $500 million last year to $555 million this year.
So, like $500 million plus GST, I guess. I suppose that's to be expected, given the increased responsibilities the ACCC is getting from government every year.
It is. So some of the line items here include $14 million over 5 years for competition reforms, and that would cover the new merger review framework, as well as getting some advice from the competition review on non-compete clauses, and also revitalising the national competition policy, which we still don't know very much about.
And it's hard to keep track of all those reforms. Lucky there's also money in the budget to develop a regulatory initiatives grid, for the financial sector at least, just to keep track of everything that's been announced and implemented.
We all need a grid like that. Then there's $68 million over 4 years to combat scams and online fraud. The ACCC gets about $27 million of that for industry codes and public awareness and the reporting of scams, and the rest goes to ASIC, the ACMA, the ATO and Treasury.
And there's about $9 million over 4 years for the ACCC's supermarket prices inquiry. Sticker shock?
That's right. There's no money specifically for other possible reforms, like the ex-ante regulation of digital platforms, which would be quite expensive to put into place. So this might suggest that the government has enough competition and consumer law reform on its plate already, and ex ante might be ad mortem, at least for now.
But overall, a steady result for the ACCC.
It is. The Office of the Australian Information Commissioner hasn't fared so well. Its budget has been reduced from $48 to $37 million, and that leaves it ahead of where it was before last year's budget, when it got a pretty decent increase. But the OAIC won't be too happy about that.
No, they say they're going to be working with the government to ensure stable and sustainable funding.
Oh, well, that sounds like Alicia Silverstone in Clueless when she renegotiates all of her grades.
Which reminds me, where's your report card?
It's not ready yet.
What do you mean it's not ready yet?
Well, some teachers were trying to lowball me, Daddy. And I know how you say never accept a first offer, so I figure these grades are just a jumping off point to start negotiations.
I'm totally bugging. And doesn't the OAIC have quite a bit to do over the next few years?
It does. So since February this year, they've had a full bench of three commissioners for the first time since 2015. That's the Australian Information Commissioner, the Freedom of Information Commissioner, and the Privacy Commissioner.
And the new Privacy Commissioner, Carly Kind, has just come from the Ada Lovelace Institute in London, which focuses on data and AI. She's already raising a lot of these critical issues here in a new role.
That's right. And perhaps as a result of that, the Attorney General has now flagged that we'll finally see some proposed changes to the Privacy Act in August of this year.
So last year, the Privacy Act review made 116 recommendations to the government.
It did. The government agreed with 38 of them, agreed in principle to 68, and noted the rest. And that included the ones that would bring political parties under the privacy framework.
So we expect that it'll mostly be the agreed ones that make it into this round of legislation?
You'd expect that, though most of the agreed ones are pretty modest or procedural in nature, or they're just agreements to consult further. The real action's in the agreed in principle ones, which are more about getting rid of exemptions, giving individuals more rights, and a requirement to always be fair and reasonable in the use of personal information.
And Commissioner Kind has said that they have 32 privacy cases before the courts, as well as 90 investigations following 2,500 complaints, plus significant enforcement cases before the end of the year.
Yeah, so it's no wonder they're keen to renegotiate their budget.
Indeed, but the government's sticking to its guns so far. Time for one more?
There's definitely time for this one. The ACCC has released a statement of issues in the Louis Dreyfus Company's acquisition of the outstanding shares in Namoy Cotton. Both companies produce cotton lint and cotton seeds, which are made from cotton plants in cotton gins, and both companies own a few of those.
I've always wondered what a cotton gin is exactly.
Well, it's short for a cotton engine, and it's the machine that separates the cotton seeds from the cotton fibres. The mechanical cotton gin was invented by Eli Whitney in the 1790s, and it's been called the worst invention in the world. It made the cotton trade much more profitable, and it greatly increased demand for enslaved people on plantations in the American South, which eventually led to the Civil War.
So maybe slavery was the worst invention in the world.
That probably is worse. Here, the ACCC has raised two red lights, two amber lights, and a green light, and it's mostly concerned about competition in the supply of ginning services to growers in northwestern Australia.
So LDC would be involved in managing and operating the only two cotton gins in that region.
It would, and the ACCC is also concerned about competition in cotton lint classing services, where LDC would have interest in the two major classes. And those are the people, or machines, who examine cotton samples and grade them on things like their strength, their maturity, and their trash percent area.
Oh, gosh, imagine if we had to be graded on those things. It'd be mortifying.
It would. In the amber lights, the ACCC is worried that LDC could use its position in cotton ginning to foreclose or frustrate competing cotton merchants and reduce the prices that it pays to growers. And it has a similar concern around LDC's warehouse in Brisbane, which is important for merchants who want to export their cotton.
But the good news is the ACCC is not worried about competition in the supply of ginning services in regional New South Wales and Queensland, where other suppliers would constrain LDC.
Yeah, that's the green light. The Louis Dreyfus Company is an old French company. It's been around since 1852, and it's owned by the extended family of Julia Louis Dreyfus, who, of course, played the Veep in Veep, Christine in The New Adventures of Old Christine, and Elaine in Seinfeld.
I'm guessing we wouldn't be here unless there was an episode of Seinfeld that talked about cotton.
There is, though Elaine has properly recused herself from commenting on the virtues of cotton in that episode, as we can hear here.
Cotton breathes. You see, it's much softer. I mean, imagine playing games and your team is 5 degrees cooler than the other team. Don't you think that would be an advantage? They're cooler, they're more comfortable, they're happier. They're going to play better.
You may have something there, George.
Oh, I've got something.
Yankees take the field.
Is it my imagination or the Yankees look a little different tonight? I can't put my finger on it.
Well, from what I understand, they've switched to cotton uniforms.
Well, they say you're softer.
Well, it is a natural fiber.
So in the end of the episode, the Yankees are humiliated when their cotton uniforms shrink in the wash.
What is with the Yankees? They look like they're having trouble running. They can't move.
It's their uniforms. They're too tight. They've shrunk. They're running like penguins.
They are. And there's an echo here in the recent news that Nike's uniforms for this year's Major League Baseball teams, which are made of at least 90% double knit polyester, have turned out to be kind of see-through.
Oh, is that fit for purpose? Do they have consumer guarantees?
We'll get to that. In the meantime, we've reached out to Julia Louis Dreyfus for comment on the ACCC's review, and she said,
"Maybe the dingo ate your baby."
Was that an Australian accent?
I think it was a version of Meryl Streep doing an Australian accent.
All right, well, I don't know how to segue from that to the deep dive, so I'll just say that, Matt, you recently sat down with Special Counsel Amelia McKellar to talk about consumer guarantees under the ACL.
I did, and those guarantees are a fundamental part of the consumer protection framework in Australia, but a lot of people, including retailers, aren't too sure what they cover and how they're enforced, or not enforced, at least not directly. Amelia had a lot to say about the guarantees and the ACCC's plans to give them real teeth, like they did with unfair contract terms last year.
Let's take a listen.
I'm here today with Special Counsel Amelia McKellar, who's previously been on the podcast to talk about multi-jurisdictional or MJ mergers, but has now written a paper on some important developments in consumer guarantees under the Australian Consumer Law. Amelia, welcome back to The Competitive Edge.
Pleased to be back here with you, Matt. Thanks.
Could you just introduce us to the consumer guarantee regime and what it does for consumers?
So put simply, Australian consumers are entitled to certain statutory rights when they acquire goods and services, which retailers and manufacturers are obliged to comply with. Critically, these are statutory rights which exist independently of any warranties a retailer or a manufacturer may also supply to a consumer with a product. And this is probably one of the biggest confusions for consumers and businesses alike. So an earlier version of this regime was previously found under the old Trade Practices Act, whereby the regime implied warranties in consumer contracts for the sale of goods or services. And then if you look far back enough, you'll find the consumer guarantee regime's origins in common law and equity. And while the consumer guarantee regime has been around in its current form for well over a decade, the ACCC has recently called for a regime overhaul to make non-compliance with the regime a contravention, i.e. illegal. This increasing push from the regulator makes the regime especially interesting to talk about today.
And what are the main guarantees there, and what happens if the goods or services don't comply with them?
So there are different consumer guarantees, a set for goods and then another set for services. And so when we are talking about goods, just by way of a few examples, consumers have the right that the good would be of acceptable quality. That means that the goods will be safe, they'll be durable and free from defects. The good would be fit for a particular purpose, the good would match a description, and that the good will comply with express warranties. And by that I mean that if a business makes an extra promise about the good, for example, that an air-conditioned unit will last for 10 years, then it has to do that. And then when you talk about services, consumers also have rights that those services will be rendered with due care and skill, that they will be fit for a particular purpose, and that they will be provided within a reasonable time.
So really important rights for consumers to have. Who is a consumer in these circumstances?
Yeah, so there are extra flourishes and exceptions that apply, but in a nutshell, we are generally talking about anyone that acquires any goods or services up to the value of $100,000. Goods or services of any value that are normally used for personal, domestic, or household use, or a vehicle or trailer. I think the main thing to note is that a consumer isn't just a mum and dad sort of individual consumer. It can also be businesses to the extent that certain criteria is satisfied.
So a supplier may want to try and exclude or modify some of these guarantees, whether it's in the fine print or in an express agreement, or maybe by talking really fast at the end of an advertisement. Is that going to work?
I think the really critical thing to note is that the consumer guarantees cannot be excluded, limited, or restricted in any way, including by contract. And there are many different permutations of businesses seeking to do just that, that is to avoid or exclude their obligations under the regime. And you see this in in-store signage saying no refunds or exchanges only, in marketing materials, in terms and conditions. And doing so puts these businesses in jeopardy in terms of not only not honouring the consumer guarantees regime, but also potentially misleading consumers as to their rights under the regime, which can open up a whole world of pain for businesses that I'll talk a bit more about later.
So at the moment, what are the consequences for not complying with one of those guarantees?
Under the current regime, if there has been some failure to meet a guarantee, both in relation to a good or a service, the consumer is entitled to some form of a remedy, with that remedy depending on the extent of the failure. Was it a major one or not? So, for example, if a good turns out to not be of acceptable quality, the consumer could be entitled to a repair or a replacement or a refund. And then if you're talking about a service and that service is not supplied, for example, within a reasonable period of time, then again, the consumer is entitled to having the services resupplied within a reasonable time, or cancelling the contract and getting a refund for any services not yet consumed. For both goods and services, consumers are also entitled to compensation for any reasonably foreseeable loss or damages suffered as a result of the failure. However, the practical problem with the regime, as the ACCC sees it, is that the regime still leaves the consumer with primary responsibility to enforce their own rights. So even if a consumer full well knows their rights and presents their case to a retailer, for example, a retailer can still refuse to honour those rights. Then the consumer is left with not a whole lot of options other than to make a complaint to a consumer body or a regulator. And the ACCC doesn't get involved in individual disputes, but they will investigate and may take action where a business has systemically misled customers about their consumer guarantee rights.
So how have the consumer guarantees been enforced in the past?
So because non-compliance with the consumer guarantees is not illegal, the ACCC's hands have been somewhat tied in terms of enforcing the regime where there has only been a non-compliance with the guarantees. However, where the conduct of the retailer or the manufacturer has gone quite a step further and involved making false or misleading statements about consumers' rights, the ACCC has taken on these cases with gusto and successfully brought actions against these businesses in court. In these cases, the ACCC has sought orders for civil penalties, declarations, injunctions, orders for compensation, also known as consumer redress, and more. And we've seen many different versions of these types of proceedings over the years. And just to give you a few recent examples, the ACCC took action against one of the biggest clothes retailers in Australia, Mosaic Brands, recently, and judgment was handed down in March. So in this case, the ACCC couldn't enforce the business's non-compliance with the guarantees. But what they could do, and what they did do, was bring proceedings for contraventions around making false or misleading representations for a failure to deliver products to customers within the delivery timeframes that they displayed on their websites, and then representations along the lines of stating consumers were only eligible for a refund for a faulty product if they sought that refund within 6 months of the purchase date. When actually, under the consumer guarantees regime, their entitlements to a refund is not time limited. And so in this case, the ACCC seeks a myriad of relief, including penalties, which we can expect to be an eye-watering figure in the millions when judgment on relief is handed down. And then I'll also bring up the ACCC's action against Mazda. So again, the ACCC could not enforce the business's refusal to provide a refund or replacement vehicle in circumstances where those vehicles had undergone multiple unsuccessful repair attempts. However, the ACCC was successful in bringing an action for Mazda's misleading representations about consumers' rights being limited to only a repair. And so following a series of appeals for Mazda's conduct involving 7 vehicles and 9 individual consumers, the federal court ordered Mazda to pay $11.5 million in penalties and $82,000 to some of the affected consumers as redress and a number of other orders for relief. And then, you know, this is a theme that has been recurring for numerous car makers, actually. So brands like Holden, Hyundai, VW, Jeep, and Toyota have all been embroiled in similar investigations with the ACCC over the years. And mind you, these are just examples of those cases the ACCC has taken to court. So the ACCC has used other enforcement measures that it has at its disposal for many, many other matters, such as issuing infringement notices and resolving matters by way of a court enforceable undertaking.
So the ACCC has achieved a certain success so far, but what are they arguing for now? What's the change that they need?
Carrying on from the car-related theme, the rubber is hitting the road now in terms of the ACCC wanting to elevate their ability to enforce the regime. The push began in March 2021 when then-Chair Rod Sims argued that the failure to comply with a consumer guarantee and unfair contract provisions should be a contravention of the Australian consumer law, subject to the same pecuniary penalty measures as other ACL contraventions. And as we know, the change was made in relation to unfair contract terms, and these changes came into effect in November 2023, but these changes did not flow on for the consumer guarantees regime. Then following some movement in 2021 and then over to 2022, there was some Treasury consultation on the issue that didn't seem to quite go anywhere. But appetite for change appeared to regain fresh focus again under the watch of then new ACCC chair Gina Cass-Gottlieb. When launching the ACCC's 2023 enforcement and compliance priorities for the year, Chair Cass-Gottlieb referred to the need for reform in her speech. Then just in March of this year, in announcing the ACCC's 2024 enforcement and compliance priorities, Chair Cass-Gottlieb once again called for reform.
And what's your sense of how big a change that would be? And do you have any sense of the timing of the reforms?
So if the ACCC gets its way, it would mean a complete shift to a contravention type regime, which allows a regulator to enforce in court non-compliance with the guarantees without a further finding of any misleading representations having been made. What this means is that the maximum penalties that would apply to non-compliance with the regime would likely be the same as those that apply to the rest of the ACL contraventions. It could mean the greater of a $50 million penalty, or 3 times the value arising from the contravention, or 30% of the adjusted turnover of the contravening business. Businesses, as a result, would really be forced to sit up and ensure they are fully compliant with the consumer guarantees regime, as opposed to being compliant in terms of what they say to consumers about their rights under the regime. As for timing, while we can see that the appetite for change is really heating up, there is no visibility on precise timing. So you'd expect some consultation around this. And then if such reforms really spark the imagination of the federal government, and then they promptly introduce a bill into parliament, we'd still be looking down the barrel of a few years before you could expect any reforms to take effect. Just for a bit of context, the unfair contract terms regime took 3 years from the exposure draft hitting parliament to actually taking effect in November last year.
So for now, until there is any reform or any progress on that reform, what do businesses need to think about?
Businesses still very much need to be aware of their obligations under the consumer guarantees regime and really need to be aware that they must ensure they are not misrepresenting consumers' rights in product or service listings or in terms of conditions or in other ways that they communicate with customers. So in practice, where we see slip-ups most is in face-to-face interactions by store assistants to customers, in overreaching in-store signage and displays, in conversations had between call center operators and customers when customers call up to complain about an issue, in marketing collateral, and in terms and conditions. For many retailers and manufacturers, there are a lot of points of exposure that they need to be vigilant about. And these businesses need to make sure their legal risk is mitigated at each point of contact with consumers, and critically, that their consumer-facing staff are properly educated on their obligations under the regime and then the ACL more generally. And the reason for this is that in addition to wanting to do the right thing by consumers, you can comfortably expect the ACCC will continue to take enforcement action where businesses mislead consumers about their entitlements and rights under the consumer guarantees regime.
So we'll keep a close eye on these reforms and we'll have you back on to explain them to us when they come around.
That would be a pleasure. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks again, Amelia.
What a great interview. So if I'm a retailer and I tell a customer they're not entitled to a refund, the ACCC can come after me. But if I tell them they do have a right to a refund, but I'm not going to give them one anyway, the ACCC can't do anything?
Basically, the customer can take you to court, of course, but they probably won't. And if you haven't said anything misleading or deceptive, and you haven't been unconscionable, then there's not much the ACCC can do.
Well, it sounds a bit unconscionable to tell a customer they've got these rights, but I'm going to ignore them. Is there anything in the budget for introducing a prohibition and penalties for not complying with the consumer guarantees?
There's nothing specific, but we can expect the ACCC to keep advocating for this change, and it does seem like something that's pretty central to their consumer focus.
Indeed. And after all that, is there anything left in your crystal ball?
Well, the ACCC has released a couple of reports last week. One was the second report on domestic airline competition under its new monitoring mandate, season two, if you like. And not surprisingly, it's focused on Bonza's departure from the Australian market.
So Bonza only competed with the other airlines on 7 of its 37 routes, including that one route where 4 airlines flew for the first time ever. And it only had 2% of the market. So how much of a competitive impact did it really have, do you think?
Probably not a huge one. The ACCC said that it had improved connectivity across the network with more direct flights to and from the regions, and that did benefit a lot of consumers. And it had at least the potential to compete more meaningfully in the future, especially if it started flying more of those major routes. But it was always limited by its small fleet. Maybe the strategy wasn't quite right for the conditions here, and perhaps its investors were spreading themselves a bit thin as well.
So Bonza is still in voluntary administration, which theoretically it could come out of?
Yeah, we saw that Virgin went into administration during COVID and it's made a complete recovery.
Well, that was under quite particular circumstances and Virgin was also in much better shape beforehand than Bonza was.
It was. Also in the report, the ACCC said they support the government's proposed reform of slot management.
Is this Arnie Slot moving from Feyenoord to be the new manager of Liverpool?
It's the proposed reform of takeoff and landing slot management at Sydney Airport, which is the most constrained airport that we have with its curfew and its cap of 80 flights an hour.
And those slots are allocated in a way that's meant to provide certainty but also allow competition, right?
That's right. And the government's not going to increase the number of daily slots available, but it'll raise the hourly cap where the airlines need to catch up after disruptions like the weather or security issues. It'll give new entrants a bit more priority when slots do become available. And it'll look more closely at the way that airlines are using their slots.
And there'll be more details in the aviation white paper to be issued in the middle of the year, to follow up on its green paper of last September.
There will. The ACCC also noted the Taylor Swift effect on the airlines. It found that Qantas had added 11,000 seats on 67 flights to bring Swifties to Sydney and Melbourne, and Virgin had also put on extra capacity.
Just wait for the Matildas effect when everyone will be flying across the country to watch the Asian Cup.
Absolutely. And if that wasn't enough, the ACCC has also released the 8th interim report in its Digital Platform Services Inquiry, Repo Number 8. This one focuses on data products and services, and in particular, how information is collected and used by data firms here in Australia.
Is a data firm the same as a data broker?
Kind of, but I guess they don't really like that term.
But it is a firm that doesn't directly collect information from you or me.
That's right. And that data might have been de-identified or aggregated, but the ACCC say it could still lead to consumer harms, not just if the data is re-identified, but also if it's used to target you as a member of a customer segment or group, especially if that's a vulnerable group. And it might be used for purposes that you didn't agree to, for example, if there's a data breach.
And the ACCC is arguing for strengthened privacy laws, as recommended by the Privacy Act Review, to be supported by further resources for the OAIC. Wait, was this written before the budget or after?
Probably before, but it's certainly timely. And the ACCC in particular argues that we should be able to have any of our personal information erased, that personal information should include any information that's related to us and not just about us, and also that the collection and use of personal information should always be fair and reasonable, no matter what we've consented to.
And those are recommendations that the government agreed to in principle, aren't they?
They are, so we'll have to wait and see whether they find their way into the draft privacy legislation in August.
So if we're talking about data, there has to be an AI angle in there.
There is. The ACCC is concerned about competition in markets for data and how firms who hold a lot of data might foreclose access to particular customers, especially when the data firms start merging with each other or with other firms who acquire a lot of data directly from end users. And the ACCC notes that high-quality data sets can become even more valuable when you add AI, and control of those data sets might limit competition in AI markets that rely on that data.
That all sounds pretty consistent with what the Privacy Act reviews already said, doesn't it? And what the ACCC said in the original Digital Platforms Inquiry.
Yeah, and actually there aren't any recommendations apart from the Privacy Act ones in this report. So it's an informative paper, but maybe not one of the most essential DPSI reports. A bit like F8, The Fate of the Furious, really wasn't the most memorable installment, though it had some great points.
Oh, thank you for that. What's in store in Repo Number 9?
Repo Number 9, I think, will be a return to form. It's due in September this year, and it'll look at general search services. That'll include issues like legislative reforms overseas, particularly in Europe, the emergence of new technologies, and trends in search quality over time.
Sounds like it's going to be a lot about Google, despite the European efforts to make Yandex and Mojik happen.
Not to mention sesdam.cz. And it does seem to me that search results have been getting a bit worse over time, with more sponsored links and ads and pop-out boxes, when really I just want to see a web page.
But some people are just looking for answers, and now everyone's pushing generative AI results that at least try to guess what you really want to know and give you what you want.
It's like Ask Jeeves, but nobody asked him.
And there are still problems with hallucinations, which means that you're going to have to click through to a website anyway. But maybe that's just a speed bump while AI is getting sorted.
Yeah, but I guess I'm predicting that search is going to get worse before it gets better.
Is this an old man yelling at the cloud?
I am Grandpa Simpson. But, you know, we were talking about this in the run-through yesterday, and I think Google must have been listening, because I've just learned that last week they introduced a kind of classic Google mode, where you can just see web links, no boxes or summaries or even ads. And they say this is for users looking for longer form text documents or using devices with limited internet access.
So basically Grandpa Simpsons.
Yeah, but I'll take it. It's a bit hidden, but there are ways to make it the default search on many browsers, which we'll definitely link to in the show notes.
But if Google was listening to us yesterday, how did they release this update last week?
Well, time travel, I assume.
Oh.
And in the same kind of vein, after our round of Barbie Monopoly last episode, Mattel has announced a range of new Barbies in the likeness of our own Matilda's striker, Mary Fowler,
whoop, whoop.
Canada's Christine Sinclair, and seven other female athletes.
Can we get one for the podcast?
Unfortunately, they're described here as one of a kind, which may mean they're only available to Mary Fowler herself.
Well, they said that about the Mackenzie Arnold jerseys, but they caved in the end.
We'll see what we can do. Mattel, if you really are listening, free the Mary Fowler Barbie.
Free Mary Fowler. Remember, you can find relevant links in the show notes and email us at edge@gtlaw.com.au.
And we've got some great guests still to come. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe, leave us a review, and tell your friends.
Till next time, this was The Competitive Edge with Gilbert and Tobin.